Michael Kostroff, Maurice Maury Levy.
But one thing about Levy is he's a good strategist, and not only does he enjoy being a good strategist, but he enjoyed showing everybody the strategy that he's come up with and how he's going to win an impossible case. He never saw that coming, particularly from a street thug, and Omar presented a really, really valid debate at that point and took him down in front of people. It was just something that he wasn't accustomed to encountering. I made a decision about Levy pretty early on, which is ugly to hear, but it really served the character. When I saw the phrase, "you people," in the first episode, that tells me a lot as somebody who's grown up around black people. I know what that means. "You people" is a racist term. I made the decision that he was very happy to work for these guys, but really didn't have a high opinion of black folks. What's delicious in particular to me about that scene is that he's taken down by somebody that he would have dismissed as not intellectual and not capable of forming that valid argument. That's what I loved about it. It hits him out of nowhere because Omar is also a great strategist and also kind of brilliant. I think that's what I love, is that Levy is shut down by the person that he thinks is just a stupid animal.
Steve Schill, director.
It was shot in a real courtroom that was actually active at the time. Normally you would shoot overnight, but for some reason we couldn't. It was an active courthouse in Baltimore. The video village was around the back, and around the back was the corridor where the defendants were being led back and forth from the cell holds to their respective courtroom. I'm sitting at video village with people being led past us in chains for real. It was, frankly, awful. It's one of the most awful things that I'd ever been involved in. I would say that this is a quintessential David Simon moment. He brought us there because this is one of the places where he had sat as a reporter for 20 years reporting on this stuff, and this is what he knew. He brought us to the real place, and by accident we ended up shooting there during working hours. I can't tell you how guilty I felt for sitting there as some jerk-off television director, making money fictionalizing what's happening to these people for real. David Simon's thrust was to expose the injustice. Even talking about it right now, I still feel bad about it. I had to move my director's chair out of their way so they could shuffle past in shackles. I feel like a piece of shit because of it.
Lawrence Gilyard Jr. passionately, yet unsuccessfully, argued with David Simon against D'Angelo's sudden and emotional demise. Many regarded D'Angelo, Avon's conflicted nephew, as the show's season one conscience. Gilyard's fellow cast members described D'Angelo's death as even more shocking and devastating than Michael B. Jordan's Wallace's killing in the first season. Frankie Faison, Acting Commissioner Irvin H. Burrell.
Whenever anyone would die or get killed, that was always tough. It was tough to lose these characters, but you have to be true to the writing. People die or disappear. There were always emotional scenes and emotional times when someone would read the script and know that their number had been called.
Steve Earle, Waylon.
Yeah, D'Angelo. He argued with David about getting killed off. When he got the script, he fucking argued with him about it. He thought he could change David's mind.
Lawrence Gilyard Jr., D'Angelo Barksdale.
The way I found out was we were in second season. I think we were on like episode 4 or something. I was coming out of my trailer. I saw David, Nina, and Ed Burns. They were walking across this lot. Ed and Nina peeled off. David just kept coming straight for me, and he goes, "Hey, what's up?" I'm like, "Hey." "So I've got some good news and some bad news. What do you want first?" I'm like, "Well, give me the bad news first." He goes, "You're not going to have to read beyond episode 6. I'm like, "What?" It was shocking. I was shocked and I was upset. I was disappointed. I said, well, what's the good news? He said, I wrote an amazing death scene for you. I'm like, that doesn't quite trump the bad news. I've been around the game for a long time. I'm a professional. So I just thought, I'll just move on beyond this. Once I read the scene and I found out how it was going to happen, I just wanted it to be a good death scene. I wanted it to be memorable. I wanted to do a good job. That person exists in the world. I always wanted to be truthful to my characters.
David Simon, creator.
Nothing was funnier in its own dark way. I didn't laugh. He said, my character is only, he's only 26 years old. He's got his whole life ahead of him. Yeah, there's so much more I could have done with his life. And therein lies the tragedy. It was really like he was pleading from real life, like any sane, life-loving human would. To hear it happen, that's exactly why it's such a tragedy.
Wood Harris, Avon Barksdale.
I thought this kid was going to be with us this whole ride. He got killed. It had unpredictability, and it added that element to the work that we were doing. It was just very unpredictable on the wire. It felt almost like a horror movie. It's scary around the corner. It added a reality to it as the actors, because we could not be presumptuous to think that we would be here the next week, even.
Lawrence Gilliard Jr., D'Angelo Barksdale.
You don't develop characters and have your fan base, your audience, fall in love with the character, and then kill them off. It's just not done, you know? It was shocking to me. It actually affected me more than I thought it would. Because before The Wire, I was already working steadily in the business. When I found out about it, I was like, all right, this is different. It was not expected, but I'll be working. I'll just keep doing my thing. I didn't realize how much it would affect me because I really loved that character. Not only how much I loved the character, but also the writing was so good, you become spoiled. It had never happened to me before because I was used to reading the regular Hollywood formula stuff. You know what to expect. When you do a show like this, you're ready for good quality writing. And you're performing on such a level with everyone who's at the top of their game. When you're done with something like that, and you move back into that Hollywood system, everything you read is crap. It took me a long time. I passed on a whole lot of stuff. It took me a long time to realize, wait a minute, this crap is the norm. That's what I'm gonna get. I have to find my way back to this.
James P.J. Ransom, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
I shot that show when I was so young. That was my first big TV gig. It kind of fucked me up because I sort of expected that everything else would sort of be that way. Nobody cared when we were shooting it, so they weren't like, you're shooting The Wire. You know what I mean? I didn't have anybody older than me being like, you're doing this amazing, prestigious thing. It was like, oh, just go ahead and shoot this show that nobody cares about. I didn't realize that the bar had been accidentally set so high in terms of writing or storytelling.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
I love season two, but I know when season two aired, we got a lot of slack because people were like, what happened to my story? What happened to our show? People were like, I had to sit through 8, 9, 10 episodes of the slowest fucking show that I fell in love with. I fell in love with these characters, and they were all gone in season two. What the fuck is that about? You had to sit in the bar and tell people, it is what it is. They would get it. They would agree with it, but they were mad. They were mad. It also, to be honest, it brought in our audience a little bit. It brought the conversation to a bigger perspective because, let's be clear, white people were not watching this show the first season. Not the masses. I'm sure there were some, but when you see more than four black people on screen, they're like, that's not my story. That doesn't have nothing to do with me, so I'm gonna change the channel. All of a sudden, in season two, white people are watching it and going, this is dope. Who's that guy? Who's this Omar guy? They start asking questions, and the black people go, you don't know who they are? Let me tell you who they are. You had these conversations, and that's what made season three big. You had two audiences who came together and started talking about this show and going, this show is amazing. This show is not following TV standards. They can just go from any angle. It's all the same narrative. It's about the community. I don't think any other show at the time was doing it like that, just changing it all up. Because season one or season two, there were no nominations. If you get a nomination, or even if you win, it's harder to change up. If it's working for you, HBO might be like, don't change nothing. Leave it like that and keep doing it. But because we were still going under the radar, HBO was like, try and do something new. Try and figure it out. See if you can get nominated. If it ain't bad, then do that. It was David Simon's and Ed Burns' plan, but they didn't get that much resistance in the changing.
James P.J. Ransom, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
The first season, you follow these black drug dealers around the streets of Baltimore, and you go, oh my God, they're trying to function as a business. Their capitalism is the same way everything else is. Then you shift focus to the white working class, right? What you really take away from that is those people are just as trapped in the machine of capitalism as the drug dealers are. People go like, the white season. It's always weird to me because it's like, no, they're just like incrementally a little bit more financially well off than the drug dealers. So to me, the takeaway from that is people go, season two is always the worst. The reason why I think people think that is because it's too much to reconcile the fact of whites in the same terms of social mobility as a poor black person. They hate to admit it to themselves. It's too much to reconcile the fact that white people are enslaved to their own social class as much as poor black people. They would have to give up the delusion that they can be wealthy one day, working honestly within the context of the system. Think about where we are as a country today. People make these great hyperbolic comparisons to Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler, and it's really wrong. Trump has benefited completely from a system of debt, right? Borrowing against your perceived value. What he's really tapping into is exactly what I'm talking about, is the delusion that you think because you are a certain sort of skin color that you are afforded more social mobility than other races or cultures. And that's just simply not true. A politician will use that in terms of going, see, the problem isn't me. It's these other people working right next to me. But if they were to compare their pay stubs, they'd see that they had more in common with that person than they would hope for.
Amy Ryan, Officer Beatrice Beattie Russell.
At the end of the first year, because I had signed a contract for the duration of the whole series, David said to me, you know, this isn't like network TV where I can write an episode and some other character can say, hey, congratulations, Beattie, you became a detective, you took the test. In reality, that would be 5 years that you'd have to go from Port Police or something like that. He said, I'm not going to do that. I have plans for you. Don't worry, but you're not going to be one of the detectives next year. I was crushed because I love the show. Wendell Pierce said to me, you gotta fight for your job. I was like, well, what am I supposed to do? I can't become detective overnight. I don't think it was every script, but David would put a few random scripts with a famous line from a movie, and just for fun, you'd see if people would figure it out. And Wendell had figured one out, and he gave me the answer. He said, go tell David you know what the line is. I was really nervous, and I go up to David, and I say, David, there's a line in one of the scripts that says, let's go. And the other guy says, why not? Is that line from The Wild Bunch? David does this double take, and he looked me up and down. He's like, ha, well, how did you know that? I was like, oh, I was just guessing. Am I right? For a second, I was like, oh my God. Okay, I'm going to make detective. He's going to change the roles. He was so impressed. He said, somebody told you. I was like, no, no, I'm right. Oh my God, I'm right. I never told him that story that Wendell told me the answer. Maybe he'll find out from this. Anyway, it didn't work, and I was finished on season two, but as you know, I came back and was peppered in through the years.
David Simon, creator.
In season two, the writers had a contest to see how many lines from The Wild Bunch we could get into the show. "Let's go" is one of the most famous lines in the film. We were deep in the season, and I think we got like 10, 15 lines in. Some of the actors got wind that we were doing it. They recognized some of the lines, more lines like, "Let's go." They were lines that really sort of stick out. She said, "I think I've got one of the Wild Bunch lines in the script." It was said to Nikki Sabatka by his uncle. I remember looking at her going, "Are you a Sam Peckinpah fan?" And she went, "Oh, yeah." I said, "Really?" There was a little part of me that went, "Somebody give you that?" "No, no, no." "Very cool, Amy."
The large size of the ensemble cast made it impossible for the actors to know every single cast member intimately. Al Brown recalled sitting at a table with Dominic West between takes in the final season. West finished telling a story and departed. Brown turned to the person sitting next to him and asked, "What the fuck was Dominic trying to talk like some Englishman for? Is he auditioning for Shakespeare?" Brown had not realized West was British, even though the pair had been with the show since its beginning. But the deaths of major characters served as bonding sessions, with Sonia San routinely gathering the cast and crew in mourning. The closeness of the actors largely broke into whom they portrayed on screen. Cops commiserated with cops. Crooks hung out with crooks. The cast would describe itself unilaterally as a family. But as with any family, occasional bickering occurred. Amy Ryan, Officer Beatrice Beattie Russell.
There was a real camaraderie with the whole group. A lot of laughs. I felt very close to Dominic in that way as well. It becomes almost sibling-like, and when our characters became romantic, it's kind of goofy. 4 o'clock in the morning, you're in bed together, and you just want to be home in your own pajamas. Like in bed with your own brother or something. Not that I know what that's like.
Lance Riddick, Lieutenant Cedric Daniels.
I definitely got annoyed with Dominic. I think it was really our personalities. I think it's ironic, but I don't think it's because of the nature of the roles we were playing. I'm an introvert, and Dominic's an extreme extrovert. He's the guy that's got to be the center of attention all the time, in my opinion, as talented as he is. I kind of just want to do my work and hang out. I just feel like there were times when Dominic got bored. It's funny, because this didn't happen when we were in a scene just the two of us. It only happened when we were in group scenes, where he was class clown. That just bugged the shit out of me. For me, everything matters.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
We had a lot of fun. It was long days in the hot sun, and we had to do something. I can't remember what I got Lance for. He was pretty serious. Lance, he's a very serious actor. He's a real professional and takes it seriously, so it was quite easy to get him.
Lance Riddick, Lieutenant Cedric Daniels.
He's a great actor, but as personalities, we're oil and water.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
Wendell and I bonded pretty quickly. He took me around New Orleans a few times, and it was interesting. The difference between us and the nationality difference, I suppose, was what sort of drew us together in a way, or what made it such an easy relationship.
Rick Otto, Officer Kenneth Dozerman.
I don't think anybody plays drunk better than Dom West and Wendell Pierce.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
We were drunk. Well, we got a lot of practice in.
Wendell Pierce, Detective William Bunk Moreland.
He's that sort of person that makes you feel like when he's dealing with you, that moment is the most important in the world at that time. That's what I really appreciated about Dominic. You can take him anywhere in the world. I took him to New Orleans for Mardi Gras once, and Clark Peters was the same way. The places that I took them was just like, God, if the production company ever found out, they'd be like, Wendell, that was dangerous. We were in the back alleys and the little bar rooms in New Orleans, just having a great time. I wanted to show them a different side of New Orleans, not something that was touristy. We had a ball of a time, because Dominic is open to that sort of thing.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
This guy stopped me and Wendell in the street, going, hey, you're in the wire, that's Wendell. And Wendell goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he said, look, man, my friend here, he plays McNulty. And the guy looked at me and went, oh, yeah, man, you're the bitch ass. You're the crybaby. That's right, you're the crybaby.
Wendell Pierce, Detective William Bunk Moreland.
The guy knew me, and I said, wait, meet my partner on the show. You remember him? He kind of thought he remembered him, but he felt as though, well, you're actors, so you must have had an emotional scene. He's like, yeah, you were crying and everything. Yeah, I know him now. He just assumed that he had this big dramatic scene that he started crying. The guy was funny. Then, what Dominic didn't say was that I had him over on Orleans Avenue, looking at the Zulu parade during Mardi Gras, and the guy said, hey, Wendell, Wendell Pierce. I said, hey, listen, don't look at me. He's on the show, too. Dominic loved the fact that he'd be able to go somewhere, they'll jump on me and crowd around me and not recognize him. I said, but no, this is McNulty. This one guy said, oh, yeah, the white boy. I had him over in the Lafitte housing projects, and everybody says, yeah, that's the white boy from The Wire. For that block, for half an hour, he was, hey, baby, come over here. It's the white boy from The Wire.
Amy Ryan, Officer Beatrice Beatty Russell.
One time we went to New Orleans for publicity, the Essence Music Festival. I'm probably the only white person in New Orleans as well, and we were all at this club dancing, and Seth Gilliam said to me, can I ask you something? Yeah. How do you feel right now? First time in my life I feel exotic. This is awesome. You know, I didn't feel shut out by the guys, and certainly if talk offset turned to a different topic that I wouldn't feel comfortable with, I would just walk away. There are lots of other women around on set working in the crew. Our DP, Uta, she was at the helm the first two seasons. And Nina, there was a female force on that show even though it wasn't represented in large numbers on screen, but the women who were there were strong and full of love and humor, and it was a nice group.
Deirdre Didi Lovejoy, Assistant State's Attorney Rhonda Perlman.
It was educational. I jokingly say I'm just a dumb white girl from Indiana. I have lived in New York for 30 years. It is not like I'm a kid. Showing up on a set that is 80% black men, I would be like, oh my gosh. That awareness was enough to make me just sort of be able to scratch the surface of what every black or Asian or whatever it is goes through every day. I have got to tell you, it is sobering.
Jen True Frost, Detective Roland Prez Presbaluski.
Both from the story and from my friends in the cast, I think I gained a much clearer window on the experience of the black characters in the story and the black actors in the show. If you're a member of the privileged majority, you can't, no matter how compassionate or insightful you are, you can't, let's just say, the closer you are to the world of people who are in the minority, and the more you're exposed to it, the more you truly can relate, I guess. In my case, in art and in drama, I wasn't only exposed to the story, but I was part of telling the story, and that was a real blessing as well.
Michael Hyatt, Brianna Barksdale.
I remember Idris before he was Idris Elba. I remember having a conversation with him on set. It must have been the second season. I was comfortable with the guys that I was working with. He was saying he wasn't sure how much longer he was going to stay in this country. He knew French or some shit. I remember him saying there's an opportunity for him to do some work in France, and maybe he should take that. I was saying to him, brother, are you fucking out of your mind? People are going to love you as this character. You're not going anywhere, dude. He was not at all conscious yet of the fanfare. He had not started receiving the fanfare from the show. He was just wondering where the fuck is his next job going to come, because nobody knew how long this was going to last. There was no promise of anything. He was trying to figure out what his next move was. I was saying, I think you should stay here. I think people are really going to like you in this show. I'm sure I had nothing to do with his choices. I'm not suggesting that. I just remember that conversation and just remember thinking, dude, you're fucking clueless. You're not going anywhere. This is going to be really successful for you.
Idris Elba, Stringer Bell.
My understanding of the show, when it got picked up, was Stringer and Avon does one season. This is about Avon. I was like, okay. By the end of the season, they were obviously still writing it. There was more and more Stringer and Avon stuff coming. At that point, they were like, we want you back for next year. I was like, really? That became clear that my character was popular. Not just my character, but the whole Barksdale clan just became more and more popular with the rest of the show.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
What was funny about Idris was, from my point of view, we would have long talks at the hotel bar. When he first got on the scene, he was really, really nervous. We were all unknowns. Wendell was probably the biggest one we knew. It just was like, I'm trying to hide this accent. I'm trying to be a believable Baltimore hood dude. He was just nervous. Nobody knew hood better than Wood Harris. That was the dude. Idris was the number two guy, and he didn't think he was doing it justice. He felt like he was faking it. We were like, fake it until you make it. You're doing great. There were always moments where we would have to check each other and reassure each other that we were doing a good job.
5. A Real Rom-Com. George Pelicanos described it as a pincer move when he and David Simon cornered novelist Richard Price before a reading at a bookstore. Pelicanos had mentioned to Simon that the pair should measure Price's interest in writing for the show. To Simon, the addition of Pelicanos had worked better than anticipated. Why not, he thought. Simon and Price enjoyed a history. Simon's homicide life on the street and Price's Clockers had debuted at around the same time. Clockers snatched Simon's interest. This gripping novel, based in a fictitious New Jersey city, captured the dual perspectives of police and an urban community. Price and Simon shared an editor in John Sterling, who once brought Simon to Price's downtown apartment, which featured a view into Jersey City. Their first playdate, as Price later labeled it, arrived the night of the Rodney King verdict. They watched the unrest unfold from Price's apartment, and the eternally curious minds then ventured to Jersey City to witness it firsthand. Price had written tons of movie scripts in the same vernacular, Simon said. He was supposed to write The Wire. Before The Wire, if they had given him the charge to write a 13-episode cop show around a drug wiretap, he could have gone in and holistically written it. Price had already made a cameo on the show during season 2 as a prison English teacher. He quickly mulled over the offer before accepting it and convened with the show's inner circle of Simon, Pelicanos, Ed Burns, and Robert Colesbury at a hotel in Tarrytown, New York, to outline season 3's focus on the death of reform and the introduction of local politics. I don't know where that money came from to send us up there, but that was nice, Burns said. I don't think we were a big hit with HBO, I'll tell you that. Bill Zorzi eventually joined the group after Price departed. He originally planned to briefly stop by and say hello to Simon, a former Baltimore Sun colleague, and instead stayed involved through the show's run. Dennis Lehane, another renowned novelist, who authored Mystic River, also joined the writing staff. The experience in the room established an atmosphere of competitiveness. Many had already described The Wire as a visual novel. Now novelists worked on most of the episodes moving forward. Yet for all the additions, the show would soon be shaken by a devastating, sudden loss. David Simon, creator.
We went to get George, and George worked out great. After that, George was introducing Price at a bookstore in Washington. Price was touring on, I want to say, his novel Freedom Land. He said, "Let's go get Price." He just said it like that. That was George. I was like, man, Richard Price is a literary lion. He was like, "Let's try it." So we both went to the bookstore and we pulled him up and he said, "Yeah, I'm interested." And then it was like, "Let's go get Dennis Lehane." At a certain point, I was just joking, like, "Who do you want now?"
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
It's very obvious why you want Richard Price. He'd already written Clockers, and all his other books fit right into what we were doing. But if you read Dennis's books, the best part is the dialogue. And it's very natural, and it's witty. We thought he'd be good for this, and it didn't matter that they were respectively from New York and Boston. I told them, "Don't worry about it. You don't need to know the street names. Just put Street, Baltimore, in the slug line. We'll plug in the street name later on. That's not why we want you. We're not coming after you because you know Baltimore through and through. You know people. That's why we want you." I think David went after Walter Mosley, too, and I don't know what happened there, but he didn't write for us.
Richard Price, writer.
When David and George asked me to do it, I didn't want to do it because my fear was that they thought, because of Clockers, I knew so much about the world of The Wire, and my feeling is I gave everything. I emptied my brain out on that book. I felt like if I wrote an episode, it's going to be The Emperor's New Clothes. Well, gee, I guess he doesn't know as much as we thought he did. I said yes, because how could you not? I killed myself in that first episode. Did ride-alongs in Baltimore, like cops in Baltimore are any different from cops in New York or L.A.
Dennis Lehane, writer.
A few years earlier, I was hanging with David, Laura Lippman, and George at a writer's conference, and David was talking about a show he'd pitched to HBO under the guise that it was a cop show. It was, at the time, in late development stages, I believe. David had this idea that he wanted to hire novelists for his writer's room because he thought most TV writers had probably picked up bad habits working on bad shows for network TV. Fast forward a few years later, and George had written the penultimate episode of season one and raved to me about the experience. He mentioned that David was interested in having me in the room for season two. Problem was that I was buried in The Given Day, and it was at a fragile point where any distraction could conceivably have killed the book. So I declined but said, "Please come back to me." And they did, and I hooked on for season three.
Richard Price, writer.
I had never been in a writer's room before. My whole experience with TV, I wrote a pilot in 1981 for NBC, and I didn't even know what I was doing. I had never done TV before, but I had known the characters just from watching. I could go do the characters. Somebody said to me, "It's like watching Donald Trump long enough on TV. You could do him. You could do a credible imitation of him. Anybody could." I had just integrated so much of each individual character that I could do it very fluidly. I'd never been in a writer's room before, and before season three, they had a meeting. It was Ed Burns, Pelicanos, and Simon in Tarrytown. It was an interesting process. They have six characters. What's the theme this year? What institution are we going to focus on? In season three, it was Hamsterdam. Okay, so what's the overall arc for Omar? What's the overall arc for the Barksdales? What's the overall arc for the mayor's office, McNulty, etc., etc.? For an overarching meeting in Terrytown, you can't get too intimate. You can't ever get to the point in an overarching meeting to say, well, in episode 6, this is what happens exactly. Because even right before you write episode 6, you're still going to be off because you still gotta consider what happened in 5. Every time you write, there's a good chance some of your stuff is going to go an episode later under another guy's name, and stuff from the episode previous is going to be shoved into yours. It's sort of an assembly line. The story trumps the author.
William F. Zorzi, staff writer.
It was sort of a fluke that I ended up being in Terrytown, which was the 23rd and 24th of July of 2003. It was at the Dolce Terrytown house. I had been in Long Island and Queens for a funeral for the morning of the 23rd, a father of a friend of mine had died. I knew David was up in Terrytown somehow, so I thought I'd just drive up and kind of drop in. I just dropped in, like, to say hi. That's how I kind of stumbled into it. And David was good enough to put me on the table as a staff writer eventually. The rest is history or something. I did all the political stuff. Ed and George had no desire to have anything to do with politics.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
Nina controls all the stuff, like where you stay. She tried to book us into a hotel up there that didn't have liquor, didn't have a bar, and we promptly booked ourselves into a different hotel. That's one thing I remember. She might dispute it, but I have brought it up with her recently. I've never forgotten that. We did find a place where we could drink at night, even though it was kind of in, to me, the boonies. For all I know, it's a nice place, but it looked like just a hotel sitting on a bunch of land. We also played handball, and Richard Price was very competitive.
Richard Price, writer.
Mainly, what I remember from Terrytown is it was like the most anti-wire setting in the world. It was a corporate events hotel. Everyone's having motivational meetings and bonding sessions for their sales corps and stuff like that. We're sitting there going, well, who's Omar gonna fuck this year? Yeah, I think a Barksdale is gonna die. Everybody else is studying the acronyms for success and getting on the links. We're sitting there killing people in Baltimore. I remember at one point I used to play a lot of racquetball. I wound up on the court with Burns and Pelicanos, but I didn't bring any shorts, so somebody lent me their shorts, and they kept falling down to my knees on the racquetball court. It was maybe the most memorable thing that happened to me there.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
I have a very good sense of story. I don't know where it comes from. Maybe being Irish, I don't know where the fuck it comes from. I know this world. I know this world intimately. I know that I can sit in a room and make a story, and it's fun to do that. There's a competitiveness there. There's bouncing off of each other. When you have a room with the talent that we had, we can always make the story. Richard Price is probably the sharpest, quickest, funniest guy you'll ever meet. When he gets on a roll, there's no story. He'll have you on the floor laughing. He's just amazing.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
All these people are writers, so they're pretty vain, and they all think that their ideas are the best ideas. And they all think that they're the best writer in the room, which is as it should be. They're dealing with the personalities and kind of pushing your ego aside because after a while, since everybody gets to know each other, it's not so polite. It's like, that's a stupid idea. We're not going to do that. All those types of things that you thought you put behind you back in high school.
Richard Price, writer.
In a script, there's no writing. It's just dialogue and directions. There's not one sentence of prose. There's no writer of a script. It's a 120-page memo to the director. Do this, say this. What The Wire had that Clockers didn't have is I kept Clockers on the worm's eye view. It rarely left the trenches. It rarely got higher than the homicide squad, if it did at all. He went to the bottom. It was like he went from the general's tent to the grunt's. I always admired that about the ambition of the show. I couldn't have written it. I didn't know anything about how the DA's office works, the interoffice politics in a police department, how City Hall works, any of that. That's a lot of Ed Burns because he had been a homicide cop. Before that, he was a military man. Zorzi had the city desk at the Baltimore Sun. Simon was a police reporter for the most part. They each had different areas of expertise. I did the best with the guys on the street, in my opinion.
Dennis Lehane, writer.
Richard is the reason I'm a writer. He's foundational. No matter how many times we've hung out, worked together, chatted each other up, I can never feel comfortable around the guy. It's fucking embarrassing, because I'm a pretty social dude, good at putting people at ease, but Richard must think I need Adderall, because I simply can't chill around him. I was 14 when I read The Wanderers in the basement of my house in Dorchester, and the world was fundamentally altered between when I picked that book up and when I put it back down. And to follow his writing for my very first teleplay 20-odd years later, that was just too daunting to contemplate, so I blocked it out. I read the notes on his episode, saw where he was going with it, then just put my head down and banged out my ep.
Richard Price, writer.
It's a real rom-com, you know? I was intimidated by both of them because of what they'd done on the show. I guess George had been reading me, but I'd also been reading George. I read Homicide and read The Corner.
Dennis Lehane, writer.
I'm an urban writer. I'm fascinated by the way a city does or doesn't work. I love the street slang and the hum of city life. The sense that within that density, a million stories are waiting to be told. The particulars of Baltimore, the names of specific streets or neighborhoods, its local patois, all of that was filled in by David or Ed.
Richard Price, writer.
The Wire was kind of painless, other than my own stage fright of giving me an episode that didn't make me look like a horse's ass. It was a writer's show, and Simon was very respectful of people he wanted to work with. Because he was the big poobah of the show, he took all the crap from HBO. He's Patton, I'm just a soldier. Tell me where to go, and I'll execute. That was very painless because I like Simon. I like Pelicanos. I like the subject. I really dug the characters. It's easy. It probably took me 2 weeks to write an episode.
David Simon, creator.
As soon as the second season happened, Ed was thinking about education. We've got to do education. We've got to do education. We're always thinking seasons ahead because guys had ideas of stuff, of slices of the city they wanted to get to. I knew we had to get to politics. You can't do education without establishing what oversees it. By then, you want City Hall as fast as you can get it after season two. But Ed was hungry to do education, and I always wanted to end on the media because I wanted the whole show to be a critique of what we're not attending to and why.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
I didn't like politics.
Richard Price, writer.
How could you not like writing Omar? No, I really liked writing about some fucking corrupt councilman. It's Omar. Everybody loves Omar.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
Every moment we saw of politics was one less moment we conceived a character that I liked.
William F. Zorzi, staff writer.
Once David drove the point home that he wanted a political storyline, I spent a lot of time with Ed, and I'm sure Pelicanos had many a laugh at our expense, really. He would just walk out. First of all, Ed has amazing stamina. He could sit there for hours upon hours upon hours and just spin up scenarios about plot lines or thoughts that he had about politics or try this one on for size, that kind of thing. We spent a lot of time sitting in that room on Clinton Street, just the two of us, after George just sort of left shaking his head, going over possible political storylines. I don't know that any of them really made it. It helped shape who the Carcetti character was, but there wasn't a lot of room, nor was there the inclination to make room, except by David's doing, for the political storyline. Ed and George were absolutely more concerned with the actual investigation by the unit and the characters who had already been established, what they were going to be doing and what their arcs were going to be. I don't think they really gave a shit about Carcetti. Ed is sort of a funny cat. It's a push-me-pull-me thing. He's completely resistant, yet he's willing to sit there for hours and days and discuss the possibilities of, well, here's an idea. These guys were not obstructionists. I'm not trying to paint them in that way. It just wasn't important to them. Politics seem like that's not what our show is. I can't remember the specifics of them saying that, but I would be willing to bet body parts vital only to me that both of them said to me, that's not our show.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
I was really against it. I fought David tooth and nail on that one. I just think growing up in Washington, D.C., as I have, politics are really boring. When I say it's boring, I think it's pretty basic.
Dennis Lehane, writer.
We were trying to break a transition in an episode once where McNulty and Greggs needed to gather the information necessary to figure out Bubbles' whereabouts. We'd been at it for a couple hours just banging on the box, and it was turning into a time suck all over this minor transition, so I said, I know it's not pretty, but what if we just have McNulty and Greggs happen across a CI, confidential informant, and ask where Bubbles is? And the CI says, the soup kitchen on such and such. So Ed Burns, who hates anything that smells even a little bit like it was something he ever saw on a shitty network cop show, leans back and folds his arms and stares across the table with a kind of bemused contempt. And he says, in 20 years as Baltimore police, I never, not once, just happened to come across a CI who was conveniently in possession of the location of another CI on the other side of the city. I mean, who is this guy, fucking Huggy Bear? And there was much snickering and pained looks of pity and commiseration for me and my dumbass idea. And for the rest of the week, Ed called me Huggy Bear or Starsky or Hutch. The takeaway there was, don't cut corners, even if it's a lot harder not to. Taught me more about how to write good TV than just about any lesson I can think of.
Chris Collins, staff writer.
A traditional writer's room is where writers get together every single day from, let's say, for regular office hours, 9 to 5. A bunch of writers sit around a table. They talk about ideas, pitch stories, that kind of thing. For instance, you might take 2 weeks to break an episode on Sons of Anarchy, which I was executive producer on. On The Wire, it took about 2 to 3 days to break an episode. We would get together for 2 or 3 days. The show basically always started out from some point of view of David or Ed that was based on some sort of historical reference or personal experience. Then it would jump off into the fiction. We'd start with that kernel of fact. Then they would somehow twist it into the fiction of the show, the mythology of the show. Those episodes were very fast. David and Ed were lightning fast in the room. I've never seen anyone in the 12 years I've been doing this professionally as a writer turn stories as fast as they do.
David Simon, creator.
In the beginning, there would be days before we even wrote a beat. We would just talk about who the character should be. First thing was, what were we trying to say? What are we trying to say about the death of work, the blue-collar story in season 2? What are we trying to say about reform in season 3? What were we trying to say about the drug war? Then, that would induce a discussion, argument. Nobody would put a card up on the board for days. After 3 or 4 days, we put a card up. Then we'd argue about that. By the time you get to episode 5, now we've opened some doors and you slammed some of those doors shut that you can't open again. You've made choices. By the end, I think it was moving pretty quickly because we committed to certain stories that we were going to tell, and we had abandoned other ones that we weren't going to tell. I didn't feel that way about it. If Chris says that about the beginning, boy, it didn't feel that way to me.
Dennis Lehane, writer.
Working with David was great. Smooth as glass. I've been told that's maybe not everyone's experience, but Dave and I worked real no-muss, no-fuss together. As far as I was concerned, I was in that room to service David's and Ed's vision, not my own. And it happened to be a vision I believed in, which made it all the easier. The biggest difference between the writer's room on The Wire and some others I've worked in subsequently is how little time we wasted. We came there to work, man, and to cut to the chase and figure this shit out as fast as we could, so we get film in the can. We investigated a lot of possible paths in terms of story, but we rarely got lost down those paths. I'd been in rooms where they'd been up and running 4 months and still had no idea what the major beats of their A storyline were.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
The very first scene we did in The Wire, the political scene, was in that deli with Burrell and Carchetti, sitting at a table negotiating with each other. After we shot it, I was being a smartass, but I said, "That's it, right? You said everything we need to say about politics. They negotiated. Each guy wanted something, and they came to an agreement. That's all it is." I sort of fought him for a long time, and I shouldn't have, but I didn't know. Once I saw it coming out, I saw what he was trying to do, which was broaden the world. You can't really tell the whole story unless you bring the politics into it, because now you've got the panorama of the city, and that's what we were missing before. He was right, and I was wrong, and I told him I was wrong.
Dennis Lehane, writer.
George is funny that way. I remember he was initially against the middle school thrust of season 4, too. But that was something I know David counted on in George, that he would push back against Dave's wonkier instincts. You can't value your own voice until people you respect question it. And you should always have at least one person around you, creatively speaking, who feels comfy speaking truth to power. The Wire, if mishandled, could have easily started to feel like homework for the viewer. George, and to a lesser degree I, pushed for the show to retain its roots as a cop show. David never saw it as a cop show. George and me did. Not just a cop show by any means, but a cop show in its DNA. The yin and yang of those competing ideas helped make it richer, in my opinion. As for the political stuff, I grew up in the shadow of a Democratic machine in Boston, so I know how that works, but I didn't know it the way Bill Zorzi did. I could play the music, but I couldn't compose it. So I just waited to hear the tempo and ran with what I was given. I enjoyed that aspect of the show, Clay Davis and Carchetti and all that. Good stuff.
The second season had closed with Nick Sabatka leaning on a fence, anguished over the death of his uncle Frank Sabatka. Steve Earle's I Feel All Right next played over a montage, punctuated with several brief, vivid shots of the decaying, neglected docks. Robert Colesbury, at the persistent urging of David Simon and Nina Noble, directed the episode and pieced together the montage. "I love the montage they concluded with," said Karen Thorson, Colesbury's wife and a producer on the show. "It's a pity. That's, for me, the saddest thing when I think back on my life with Bob. I would have liked to have seen him go forward with that. And he would have done well. He would have done better and better. And I can only imagine what other things he would have directed, and whether he would have remained a producer. I think he would have remained a producer-director. I think he would have remained in television. But at least he got there. It hurts my heart to think of that lost opportunity for him." Colesbury, the man Simon eternally credits as the eyes of the show, died suddenly in February 2004, following complications from heart surgery. Thorson, Simon, and Noble were among those at his bedside in his final hours. The loss sent the cast and crew, just weeks from starting to shoot season 3, into deep mourning. Colesbury had established the show's visual template, Beyond that, he had been a teacher and mentor, someone who possessed a quiet, steadying influence. Colesbury had calmed down an antsy Dominic West. He had gone horseback riding with Clark Peters. He had offered the right advice when he sensed someone was hesitant to ask. He had an impressive past, having worked with a number of well-known directors, and seemed primed for an even brighter future. As a producer, he had been soft-spoken, subtle, and discreet, Simon wrote in an appreciation of Colesbury for the Baltimore Sun. He made his points after everyone else in the room had already had their say. Bob could back you into a better idea and convince you that it was probably your own. And he was forever pathfinding through the forest of overgrown ego that flourishes on any movie set. Thorsten, Simon, and Noble privately spread some of Colesbury's ashes on the set during the first day of filming season 3. The writers wrote in a wake for Detective Ray Cole, the minor character Colesbury played on the show, in the third episode of the season. In it, Jay Landsman, Delaney Williams, delivers a eulogy peppered with tributes to Colesbury and his work on films such as Mississippi Burning and After Hours. Aidan Gillen, Mayor Thomas Carchetti.
We met at Bobby's in Tribeca for breakfast. We had a good long chat, about an hour. He was outlining this character he said they were thinking of introducing and that he was a politician. I'm thinking, wow, I've never played a character like that before. And I hadn't. Hardly any establishment figures, but lots of the opposite. I hadn't seen The Wire, and as Bob described it, I remarked that it sounded like the John Sayles film, City of Hope, and Bob said that he was involved in the production of that film. Having that touchstone prompted further movie chat and general chat, and at the end, we bid our farewells. He said they'd keep in touch, and I walked away thinking, fuck, that sounds good. About 6 weeks later or so, I asked my agent what the story was. So she put in a call, and the word came back that Bob had died just the day before, which was astonishing news, obviously, as he seemed so vital. A few weeks later, I got the call to come in and try out the scenes. I got cast, and the first day on set was actually a memorial service for Bob. There was a red sports car parked on the set, which was inside a big warehouse space, and I asked, whose car was that? It was Bob's. Then, on the show, they gave his character, Ray Cole, an Irish-style wake, including the song Body of an American by the Pogues. For someone I only met for an hour, it feels like I knew him a bit more than that would afford, and the upshot of that hour was that he and Alexa Fogel changed the trajectory of my career, and I'll be eternally grateful for that. It was nice getting to know his widow, Karen Thorson, a bit over the subsequent few years.
Seth Mann, director.
I do not know who handed Bob Colesbury my short film. He got a hold of it and reached out to me and invited me to a coffee. We went and talked. He was very complimentary about the film, very cool, and said, come shadow on the show. I said, great. I'll never forget, on the way in, Ed Bianchi came in, and that was his next meeting. He introduced me. He said, hey, Ed, this is a young director. I remember it was cool because he called me a director. I had a 22-minute short. This guy had obviously directed I don't know how many episodes of television. That was the one and only time I talked to Bob Colesbury. I never saw him again because, unfortunately, he passed away. A couple months later, I get a call from Nina Noble saying, Bob was a big fan of yours. And out of respect of his memory, we'd like to invite you to come shadow on a show. We have a place for you to stay in Baltimore, and Ed Bianchi has already agreed to let you shadow him.
Jeffrey Pratt Gordon, Johnny 50 Spumanto.
The night that Robert Colesbury passed away, there was an HBO function in New York, and I was with Chris Bauer, Andre Royo, Omar was there, his assistant. It was a very social, very light atmosphere. We were either at a bar going to the party or leaving the party and going to a bar. And I remember walking down the street and Andre Royo got a call. And as we were walking and talking, he was on his phone. He hangs up and says, Guys, I've got some bad news. We all stop on the corner in New York, and he said, Colesbury just passed away. I got